Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Timeless stories, exceptional storytellers. Discover all your favourite BBC radio dramas available to enjoy as audiobooks. John Moffat stars in Poirot's Finest Cases, a collection of gripping full-cast dramatisations based on the novels by Agatha Christie.
And what would be your ideal murder mystery, Poirot?
A very simple crime. A crime with no complications. A crime that was unimpassioned and tame.
Search for BBC Audio wherever you purchase audiobooks and start listening.
We lost our humanity. We lost our dignity. We got punished for something we did not do.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
Our young lives were flipped upside down.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday, February the 21st, these are our main stories. Another test of the UK's nuclear missile programme fails. We examine who or what was to blame. New research links some of the world's largest meatpacking companies to illegal deforestation in Brazil. And a coalition government is formed in Pakistan. We hear opinion from the streets of Karachi. Also in this podcast, the widow of Haiti's murdered president defends herself from allegations of involvement in her husband's death. We hear from her lawyer. UNICEF warns that Gaza's children face a nightmare of malnutrition. And
family members getting as much abuse, sadly, as the players do. Sometimes more abuse is sent to them than the players themselves.
The Premier League speaks out about online abuse. The British Ministry of Defence has insisted that the UK's nuclear deterrent remains safe and effective, despite the second successive failure of a test firing of a missile designed to carry warheads. The ministry said an anomaly occurred during the test, but did not give further information. With the Defence Secretary and the head of the Navy on board to watch it launch, it does, to say the least, look like an embarrassing failure. Jerome Starkey is the defence editor of The Sun newspaper, and he got the scoop. He's been talking to Rebecca Kesby.
Well, embarrassing really is the word, but the message that the Minister of Defence in the UK are really keen to stress is that this hasn't undermined their nuclear deterrent. They insist that this was an isolated incident, a missile misfired. Now, what we know is that one of the Royal Navy's four Vanguard-class submarines, those are the submarines which can carry nuclear-armed missiles, one of those submarines was conducting a test off the coast of Florida last month. And as part of that test, it was expected to fire an unarmed Trident II D5 missile. Now, the Trident missile blasted upwards out of the launch tube. These missiles are stored vertically in the submarines. It blasted through the water and into the air, propelled by a cloud of compressed gas. And at that point, once it was airborne, its first stage rocket booster should have ignited. But that failed. The first rocket booster failed and it crashed back into the ocean just yards away from HMS Vanguard, the submarine that had launched it.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC's been speaking to the MOD at various points on this today, and they are telling us, those sources, that this wouldn't happen in a real world launch. I guess that would mean during some sort of military activity and with a warhead on board. The trouble is, though, Jerome, this did happen again in 2016, didn't it? On another failed test.
Well, you're right. I mean, there's no escaping the facts, which are there have been two unsuccessful test launches of the Trident II missile from Royal Navy submarines. Now, the circumstances are slightly different. In 2016, the missile came out of the submarine. Its boosters did ignite, but in that occasion, it veered off course and it automatically self-destructed. Taken together, that means that the last successful test fire of a Trident II missile was more than 11 years ago, because they cost about £17 million each.
Jerome, you mentioned how expensive it is to run these tests, multiple millions of dollars. And the UK is spending, I think it's around £40 billion. That's probably, what, $70 billion or so in upgrading its nuclear deterrent at the moment. This is at a time when the UK is a bit cash strapped.
The UK is one of only two nuclear powers in Europe together with France. But this costs us around £3 billion a year. That's around 6% of the defence budget. So it is expensive. But when MPs were asked to vote in 2017 as to whether or not we should renew the deterrent and replace these Vanguard class submarines with a new generation of Dreadnought submarines, that got overwhelming support. Ultimately, it probably won't come as a surprise to many of your listeners that the world feels like a more dangerous place at the moment. That is why the UK keeps a nuclear deterrent.
Jerome Starkey of The Sun newspaper. Almost 2 weeks after the national elections in Pakistan produced no clear winner, two political parties, the Pakistan Muslim League and the Pakistan People's Party, have reached a formal agreement on a new coalition government. It is likely to see Shehbaz Sharif become Prime Minister for a second time. Supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who was currently in prison, say the election was stolen because they won the most seats, although not enough to get a majority. Rayouf Hassan is the spokesman for Imran Khan's PTI party.
It's a coalition among dacoits and thieves, basically. Now, this coalition of the corrupt has been imposed in Pakistan yet again, not through a democratic process, but by midnight operation, you know, where they ran away with about 82 of our seats, you know, extending an artificial majority in the parliament to this coalition. We have three options, basically. We have been elected to the parliament in spite of the opposition from the powers. So we definitely want to play a constitutional role sitting within the assemblies, both at the center and in the provinces. Two, we have legal recourse and we shall be taking our cases to the courts, you know, wherever applicable. And the third option that we have is, as a political party, the constitution of the country gives us a right for peaceful protest. And we definitely intend to use that also as and when needed.
This was the reaction of some people in Karachi.
It seems like a joke. These politicians have been ruling this country for the last 40 years. They're being imposed on us once again. I don't think this government will last long. Today, the economy of the country is in a shambles. Last time they were in power, what did they do for the country?
It's impossible for people to get any relief because there are all the same politicians. They mudsling each other during the elections. Then they enter into power again with each other. So I don't think people will get any relief.
Our South Asia regional editor is Ambaras Netarajan.
Supporters of Mr. Imran Khan, who is currently in jail, they will question the legitimacy of the government because what they say is that we won the highest number of seats, even though we did not get majority. And they also allege a massive state-orchestrated election fraud. They said they won two-thirds of the seats, though the government and the election commission have rejected this agreement. The second thing is what we see is the Act 2 of what happened before the election. That was a coalition between these two major political parties, Pakistan Muslim League and the Pakistan People's Party. That government was hugely unpopular because they had to increase electricity and gas tariffs. Price hikes were common. They had to go to the IMF for an emergency loan. Now, the same two political parties, which came number two and number three, they are forming a coalition. So Mr. Khan's supporters will continue to ask the legitimacy of this government because they say they have been rejected by the people.
And how stable is Pakistan now? Because there are some huge issues facing the country.
Pakistan needs stability at this moment, both for economy and for political situation, because the country is facing an inflation rate of about 28%. Cost of living crisis is hitting the people hard. And you have seen a number of electricity prices hike. So that is hitting people, a common man on the ground. So they need a stable government to revive the economy. And again, the militant attacks in the northwest have been increasing, and they've been accusing the Pakistani Taliban of carrying these attacks. Even though military is in the background trying to form a coalition government here, now what they want to see is a government which can engage with the other political leaders, other governments in the world to bring economic growth as well as to provide security.
Ambarasan Etarajan. The US has vetoed the latest attempt at the United Nations to demand an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The latest diplomatic stalemate comes as the UN's children's agency, UNICEF, warns of a potentially deadly rise in malnutrition among children in the enclave, where it's estimated nearly 2 million Palestinians have been internally displaced. That's had a significant impact on health. This woman was in Rafah.
I live in the European area. All the time I hear the sounds of missiles, strikes and aircrafts flying over our heads. There is no safe place for us. They say that we must take our belongings and head to Al-Mawasi. We have been displaced twice already. There is a scarcity of water and the rain is pouring over us. Our condition is very miserable. I wonder what kind of sin we committed to be humiliated in this way. They target al-Mujahideen, all the resistant fighters. But where are those fighters? What did our children do to be subjected to all this tragedy? Whoever was displaced to Rafah has returned again to Khan Yunis. The existence of a safe area in Gaza is nothing but a lie.
Salim Owais is the communication officer for UNICEF's Middle East and North African regional office in Amman.
What we're seeing is a real rise in malnutrition in the Gaza Strip, in the north especially, which now has 1 in 6 children under 2 years suffering from acute malnutrition. That's 15.6% of the population there. This is a really huge increase in numbers. And to be honest, it's unprecedented globally, the increase within this time frame. We're talking about 4 months. What we're seeing now is even in the south, which is receiving some aid, we have 5% of the children are acutely malnutrition. It's really imperative now to get the aid into Gaza across the strip, not only to the south. When we're talking about malnutrition, it's more than just not having the food and being hungry. If this continues, we're risking their lives. That's one. That's the most important part. But also risking their future. If this continues and they don't get the services that they need, the treatment that they need, their bodies will be weak and their immune system will be weak. And we are already seeing a spread of diseases. 90% of the children that we interviewed had at least one communicable disease already. So with a compromised immune system because of the malnutrition, we're going to see a rise of these diseases and consequently a threat to their lives.
Salim Owais of UNICEF. As we record this edition of the Global News podcast, a pioneering European satellite is due to plunge into the Earth's atmosphere. The ERS-2 was a cutting-edge observation platform that helped forge technologies that are now routinely being used to study the planet, monitoring floods, the movement of ground during earthquakes, and tracing the flow of ice fields. This was the launch 29 years ago.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, top. Allumage.
The European Space Agency says most of the satellite will burn up in the Earth's atmosphere. Earlier, I spoke to the BBC science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
It was really the technology in Europe that gave birth to what we now recognise as Earth observation. So, you know, quite often science reporters like me come on and we talk about what's happening on planet Earth. And that's done by satellites moving overhead, taking pictures, taking soundings of the atmosphere, looking at how the ice moves, how the Earth buckles in earthquakes. And the idea of how to do that was really born on this type of satellite, Earth remote sensing satellite. The European Space Agency launched two back in the 90s, and it kind of all stems from these. And one of them is still up there, ERS-1. It's quite high up. ERS-2 is the one that's going to come back today, and we're expecting it to fall into the atmosphere around about 4:30 GMT, although there is some uncertainty about that because it all depends on how it interacts with the atmosphere as it scopes along the top of the air that surrounds the planet.
And in your piece on the BBC website, you say most of the satellite will burn up in the Earth's atmosphere, but the more robust parts may make it to Earth. But you say the chances of hitting built-up areas are slim. But of course, slim is not zero.
Yeah, you've got to remember that 71% of the planet is covered by oceans. So if you're going to lay a bet, you would say it's going to end up swimming any parts. Yeah, I mean, it'll come screaming in, you know, several kilometres per second. And at that velocity, as it hits the atmosphere, about 80 kilometres up, it's going to start melting. Metal parts will start melting. Everything will start burning. There are one or two bits and pieces that are likely to make it through all the way to the surface. There's some carbon fibre bits and pieces, like on the radar antenna, that might make it through. Some metal casings on tanks, pressure tanks, fuel tanks. But the chances of it, you know, those things hitting, you know, the middle of a town or a city, famous last words, are very slim indeed. You know, we do expect most of these things to end up going into the water.
Jonathan Amos. England's Premier League has set up a dedicated team to hunt down online trolls who've been targeting football players and their families. The league say it's taken the action to help stem the rising tide of social media threats. The BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent, Mariana Spring, has been given exclusive access to the team and told me more about its work.
Whenever you're watching a game and someone gets sent off, or maybe they score a penalty or miss a penalty, or they score a last minute winner, you know that they are likely to be subject to some kind of abuse or hate online. And, you know, that can be worse if they also experience racist hate or other forms of abuse. So I think it's something that has almost become part and parcel of being a footballer and being in public life more generally. But where it gets really scary is threats where people are worried that someone might actually turn up at their house or come and find them.
And you've been speaking to a player in particular who has a fairly shocking story to tell.
Neil Mopé, who's a striker right now for Brentford, but at the time when he was playing for Brighton, another club, they played Arsenal in this game during the COVID-19 pandemic, and he injured unintentionally Arsenal's goalkeeper. He also scored a last-minute winner. And when he came off the pitch, he obviously received lots of congratulations from friends and family. But soon it became a lot more sinister and he realised he was being subject to a very high volume of online abuse. And there were some particularly threatening messages that caused concern to him, basically suggesting that the person was going to come and attack his family or come to his home. So he decided that he wanted to do something about it. And this was his reaction to receiving those kinds of messages.
It was very disturbing, you know, because I received one saying basically, I know where you live, I will come to your house tonight and I'm gonna kill you and your family. I called the club and I said, listen, we need to do something, because what if that guy is really coming back to my house?
And what can the Premier League actually do here?
So Neil Mopé referred, through his club, referred these messages into this new troll-busting unit that exists in the Premier League. It was set up back in 2019, and it uses basically the same techniques that they use to find people who are illegally sharing streams of matches to track down players' abusers and find out who's sending that hate. They have two options. One is that they can report and flag the most abusive content that could be in breach of social media companies' guidelines, who then might take it down. And they are able to compile a dossier of evidence about the person who might be behind that account and share it with the relevant authorities. There are a couple of things that really struck me during the conversation I had with Tim Cooper, who is the head of this troll-busting team. The first was that a huge volume of this abuse is coming from overseas. They say 80% of it comes not from within the UK, but from places all over the world. And that was certainly the case with Neil Mopé's troll, who turned out to be a 19-year-old based in Singapore called Derek Ng Duren. They shared the relevant evidence with the authorities in Singapore, and he was later prosecuted for sending those messages and received 9 months. But the other thing that I've found really striking is just the way that anyone connected to players becomes fair game. And one of the things Tim told me about was how friends and family in particular are seeing a real rise in the kind of hate that they experience.
We see family members getting as much abuse, sadly, as the players do, and they can report to us to then investigate the direct messages that have been sent to them. Sadly, sometimes that is more abuse is sent to them than the players themselves.
I think what this tells us beyond football, and this is about a lot more than football because a lot of people experience online abuse in different ways, is that while there perhaps is benefit in holding trolls to account for their behaviour, there are a lot of people that have to be held to account for what's going on, whether that's the social media companies, authorities, and I guess society in general, the approach we take, you know, how do we stop this behaviour even happening in the first place? So for me, one of the important things, I think, aside from all of the accountability, is just to be able to talk about it and to speak up. And I I think certainly Neil Mopay, speaking to me, hopes that by talking about his experience of online abuse, it might encourage other people to speak up about theirs.
Mariana Spring. And there's more on this story on her podcast, Why Do You Hate Me?, which is available on BBC Sounds. Still to come.
We believe that Kurti's regime will continue with disruptions and new tricks. They'll take actions against the normal life of Serbs because they think the only way to win is if there are no more Serbs in Kosovo.
Kosovo Serbs fear for their future as the dinar is banned.
When you see Iran close up, you realise just how complex a political landscape it is.
The Global Story. Smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story.
It seems that Iran's strategy at the moment is to increase the tension in the Middle East.
Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
When Israel does agree to a ceasefire in Gaza, Iran will then worry about Israel then turning its sights towards Iran again.
The Global Story. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Three major beef production companies in Brazil have been accused of links to deforestation. The environmental rights charity Global Witness says it has found that JBS, Minerva and Marfrig are sourcing cattle from land that's been illegally cleared on the Cerrado Savannah. Simon Roach from Global Witness explained the importance of the research.
The investigation is important firstly because while we already knew that deforestation in the Cerrado has been rising, it reveals what and who has partly been driving it. And that's crucial for accountability if the world wants to actually protect these vital ecosystems.
Daniel Gallas is the BBC Brazil reporter.
Everyone who looks at the map of Brazil sees a huge chunk of land, green chunk of land on top on the north, and that's the Amazon. And right under it, there's another huge chunk of land, which in map satellites usually is not as green. That's the Cerrado. It's a savanna, very mixture of forest and desert, very bushy and very dry. Up until the 1970s, there wasn't a lot of settlement there, and there wasn't even a lot of forest there. But since then, scientists discovered how to actually raise crops there, and it has become a huge source of crops for Brazil. And it's one of the engines of Brazil's growth in economic growth in the past two decades, at least.
And what have the companies had to say in response to Global Witness's allegations?
Well, the three companies denied that they're doing any extra illegal deforestation. And one of the companies said that it actually abandoned some of the farms that are being accused because these are farms that they source products from. So that's their side from the story.
And the area stores billions of tons of carbon dioxide. And what impact does deforestation have on the Cerrado's ability to store that?
Yes, well, people talk a lot about the Amazon, which is the world's greatest carbon storage place in the world. But the Cerrado is not too far behind. It holds 13.7 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which is kind of about what China released in carbon dioxide last year. The Cerrado tends to get very overlooked internationally just because there's so much attention to the Amazon, not just internationally, but in Brazil as well. People talk a lot about the importance of preserving the Amazon, but there isn't much talk about the Cerrado, despite it being a beautiful land with, you know, a lot of varieties of plants and animals.
And just finally and briefly, there had been some hopes that President Lula would actually cut the amount of deforestation in the Amazon region. Is that happening?
Well, that is happening drastically in the Amazon region. It cut by half in the first year of his administration, and it has been a win for his government, a lot of people say. But the problem is places like the Cerrado, deforestation went up by 43%. So that's due to lots of problems that the government has in tackling deforestation in that place. It's in a way, it's been easier to tackle deforestation in the Amazon than it has been in the Cerrado.
Daniel Gallas. More than 50 people have been indicted over their alleged involvement in the killing of Haiti's president Jovenel Moïse in 2021. One name really stands out: the late president's wife and former first lady, Martine Moïse. She was among those injured when armed men stormed the presidential palace and shot dead her husband. The indictments have been brought by a Haitian judge and are different to a separate trial that is underway in Miami, where half a dozen Colombian mercenaries have already admitted their involvement in the assassination. James Copnell has been speaking to Marty Moishe's lawyer, Paul Turner.
In this case, there was a heinous crime, which was the assassination of the president. But in that assassination, Mrs. Moishe was also shot multiple times and sustained significant injuries that she had been evacuated to the U.S., to U.S. hospitals. And she has permanent physical damage even to this day from that crime. Also, her family, her kids were there, right? And so their kids had to avoid, you know, their, bodily harm themselves. So the real issue here is we were hoping to get through the criminal trial that the U.S. government is bringing in May of this year against the remaining defendants that they have incarcerated here. Six of them have already pled guilty. And in pleading guilty, you know what they didn't say? That Moishe had anything to do with the assassination of her husband or the shooting of herself. So we are at a total loss as to why or what grounds they're relying on to assert that she had any role in the shooting of herself, the life-threatening actions against her children, and obviously the assassination of the president, her husband. Now, the only thing we can think of is that they're taking a page from the dictator's handbook, right? Grab power, hold power, don't relinquish power. And you can just look and see Putin did that. And he obviously did it successfully. His political opponent was, you know, brought to kangaroo court, went to prison and just perished, just died. And so I think that there's a fear in the Haitian political group at this time that she might run for president.
Your client then, Martin Moishe, is a political threat.
That's the only thing that makes sense. Why would they want to indict her and threaten to put her on trial and incarcerate her when she's a victim? It's classic victim blaming.
Paul Turner. Kosovo is facing calls from its international partners to suspend the implementation of a ban on the use of the Serbian currency. The regulation banning the dinar is the latest in a series of moves by Kosovo's government to assert its authority over majority Serb areas. And a relatively muted reaction from Serbia has left Kosovo Serbs wondering whether they still have Belgrade's backing, as our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay reports.
Withdrawing money from a cash machine is a process that most of us take for granted, but not Kosovo's ethnic Serb minority. That's because Kosovo's central bank has recently banned transactions in any currency other than the euro, and Serbs mostly use the Serbian dinar. Serbia's president, Aleksandar Vučić, accuses Kosovo's Prime Minister Albin Kurti of systematically persecuting Kosovo's Serb minority.
The goal is the ethnic cleansing of the Serbian population from the territory of Kosovo and Metohija, deliberately subjecting Serbs to unbearable living conditions. We believe that Kurti's regime will continue with disruptions and new tricks. They'll take actions against the normal life of Serbs because they think the only way to win is if there are no more Serbs in Kosovo. We will do everything in our power to ensure that Serbs remain.
North Mitrovica is the largest majority Serb town in Kosovo. Thousands of people here work in Serbian institutions, including schools and hospitals. They were given only 2 weeks to adapt to Kosovo's new currency regulations. But Prime Minister Albin Kurti insists there isn't actually a ban on the dinar. He says the regulations are designed to keep Kosovo citizens safe from fraud.
We are not banning dinar, Serbian dinar. People can have Serbian dinars, but the only mean of payment is euro.
The forced installation of ethnic Albanian mayors in majority Serb areas triggered violent scenes last May. Kosovo's authorities have also removed Serbian insignia from public buildings and forced Serbs to surrender their Serbian-issued vehicle license plates. These are all issues which cut to the heart of Kosovo-Serb identity, but they passed with relatively little complaint from Serbia's capital, Belgrade, and that's left Kosovo-Serbs feeling insecure.
People really are losing hope.
Jovana Radosavljevic is from North Mitrovica and runs the New Social Initiative, an organisation that tries to build trust between Kosovo-Serbs and the Albanian majority.
It is disappointing to see no stronger messages coming in from Belgrade, no strong messages from the local leaders as well. So we're basically left completely in this leadership vacuum.
Kosovo Serbs feel stuck between the authorities in Pristina making their lives more difficult and those in Belgrade whose support appears to be waning. The latest figures suggest that 1 in 10 of them have left in the past year. If they can't get paid, more may join that exodus.
Guy Delorne. The Biden administration has strongly criticized an Alabama Supreme Court for ruling that frozen embryos are legally children. The White House press secretary said last week's decision would have devastating consequences, undermining women's access to reproductive care and to contraception. The top U.S. Infertility Association, Resolve, called the decision a terrifying development for those who need IVF to have a child. Speaking to reporters, the Republican governor of Alabama, Kay Eve, defended the court's involvement.
As I've said many times, we foster the culture of life and protect the sanctity of life. And we also respect the work of our courts. And though I hadn't read all 150 pages of their ruling, we respect their work, and I'm sure there'll be more discussions on this topic, and I'll follow that issue very, very closely.
Kay Eve, the governor of Alabama. Simadele Adiagbo is an undoubted trailblazer. In 2018, she became the first Nigerian to compete at the Winter Olympics and also became the first black female Olympian in the sport of skeleton. This week, she's competing at the Bobsleigh World Championships in Winterberg in Germany. On the same track 2 years ago, she became the first African to win a World Cup race when she claimed the monobob title. And she's looking forward to her latest run.
I feel a great privilege, first of all, for the opportunity to take this huge step forward for not only Nigeria, but for the continent of Africa. You know, the IBSF, the International Bobsled and Skeleton Federation, has just celebrated 100 years of existence. And in that century, there has been no African athlete in bobsled that has competed at the World Championship. So it took a whole century to break this barrier. And so for me, I feel very privileged and honored to be the one that has this opportunity to do this on the world stage. And I'm very proud to be representing Nigeria and the continent of Africa. So I really just want to just show up for the country and the continent to really show that not only am I breaking this barrier and making this history, but really just compete with the rest of the world. So I'm that for me, it would be success. I've had to just overcome so many barriers just to get here, but I'm here and now it's just time to show the world what Nigerians can do. While the landscape continues to grow, I think in small ways, I think the bar has been set in terms of different examples that we can pull from to show that it's possible. Not only myself, but my teammates that I made history with back in 2018. In 2022, Nigeria had representation at the Beijing Olympics with a ski athlete. And even when you look at the Youth Olympics that just took place a few weeks ago in Pyeongchang, there was a Nigerian curling team. So we are seeing some small steps forward, but I'm hopeful that the investment will be made for it on the continent of Africa. I think it's going to take a very intentional plan and a strategic plan for it to be sustainable going forward.
That was Simadele Adiagbo, who's competing for Nigeria at this week's World Bobsleigh Championships. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Gabriel O'Regan, and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.
Timeless stories, exceptional storytellers. Discover all your favourite BBC radio dramas available to enjoy as audiobooks.
John Moffat stars in Poirot's Finest Cases, a collection of gripping full-cast dramatizations based on the novels by Agatha Christie.
And what would be your ideal murder mystery, Poirot?
A very simple crime. A crime with no complications. A crime that was unimpassioned and tame.
Search for BBC Audio wherever you purchase audiobooks and start listening. Timeless stories, exceptional storytellers. Discover all your favourite BBC radio dramas available to enjoy as audiobooks. John Moffat stars in Poirot's Finest Cases, a collection of gripping full-cast dramatisations based on the novels by Agatha Christie.
And what would be your ideal murder mystery, Poirot?
A very simple crime. A crime with no complications. A crime that was unimpassioned and tame.
Search for BBC Audio wherever you purchase audiobooks and start listening.